If you'll take your Bibles and open up with me to the book of Matthew, the Gospel according to Matthew. It's always exciting to start a new book. There's a sense of accomplishment in a way where you finish a book when you've been preaching through it, and you know you've been in it for a while, usually, especially an Old Testament prophet like we had just finished, and you know you're kind of ready in a sense to see what you're going to get into next. And so there's always an anticipation and an excitement with a new book, but there's an added excitement, at least for me, when I get ready to preach through a gospel. There's a uniqueness to the gospels and a specialness to the gospels that they're special to the life of Christ, special to a Christian, and so it's always great to begin a book like this. We preached through John. I had the pleasure of being able to preach through that, and that was a great joy. And so now we're on our second gospel, Matthew, and I'm looking forward to preaching through that tonight. Most of what I'm going to preach tonight will be the intro to Matthew. I'm going to try to give you guys a good setting, a good background, talk to you about the themes of the book and what we should expect as we work through the passage or through the book. I do plan on covering the first 17 verses tonight, which are they are a genealogy. I know that may sound like a lot, 17 verses, but we should be able to work through them fairly quickly once we get to that point. But as we get into Matthew, I think it's important to set our context, to give us our setting of this book. And I mean, I'm sure some of what I will tell you tonight will be familiar to you. You'll have already known a little bit of this. I hope that I can fill in some gaps or tell you some things that maybe you didn't know or had forgotten. But the last word that Israel had received from God in the Old Testament prior to Matthew was through the prophet Malachi. And the final events recorded in the Old Testament were those recorded in Nehemiah 13 around 425 B.C., so for the next 400 plus years, God was silent. He was not speaking through a prophet to Israel or to any other nation, obviously. There was no word, whether of judgment or instruction or encouragement, that was given to them. There was a lot going on during that time, though, during those silent years. Much of what Daniel had prophesied began to play out during that period of time, and it played out, obviously, precisely as he had prophesied through the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. Now, if you recall, if you were here with us through the study of Ezekiel, Israel had been in captivity when we left Ezekiel, right? They were in captivity there in Babylon due to the judgment from God. And a portion of that nation, they eventually returned from exile to the Promised Land there in 538 BC, about 113 years prior to the end of the Old Testament, to the end of that beginning of that silent time, those silent years. They did so. They returned to reestablish their heritage and, more importantly, to rebuild the temple for worship to Yahweh. Now, the last event recorded in the Old Testament, again there in Nehemiah, it pertains to proper temple worship to Yahweh and to living in such a way that would set the Jews themselves apart from these pagan nations around them, a thing they should have been doing, had been told to be doing for a long time. Even more significantly, though, and more importantly to the book of Matthew, when God began to speak to Israel again, the last recorded word through the prophet Malachi is full of covenant language. So prior to him speaking through a prophet, which we will read here in Matthew, the last thing that he spoke to the nation of Israel was covenant language there. It was about God's love for His people and the promise of the Messiah who would come. Maybe the most significant thing that we see, especially pertaining to the book of Matthew, is that when they returned there to Babylon, that small covenant or the small remnant, when they returned to the Promised Land after being in Babylon, they had no king on the throne. There was no king that sat on the throne there. In fact, no Davidic king sat on the throne from the time that they were deported to Babylon all the way through the coming of Jesus. So after the Old Testament canon was closed, the land of Israel, it fell into the hands of the Greeks. And at the leadership of Alexander the Great, Alexander allowed the Jews in Judea to start observing their own laws. He even exempted them from some taxes, specifically during their sabbatical years. They had some liberties. But the Greek culture there began to permeate the Jewish culture. Alexander and those who followed him in rule wanted all of their conquered lands really to be saturated in that Greek culture known more commonly as Hellenism. We see that pop up in the New Testament quite a bit, that term Hellenism. This culture was attractive, it was sophisticated, it was humanly appealing, but it was utterly ungodly. And it was as dangerous to the Israelites as any prior pagan worship had been. And that will be important as we continue to set the stage for Matthew. All the way moving forward a few hundred years, in 198 BC, Antiochus III entered the world stage. And under the direction of his son, Antiochus Epiphanes, all religious toleration or exemption for the Jews that they had enjoyed under Greek rule and Egyptian rule, it ended. In 170 BC, Antiochus Epiphanes, he desecrated and plundered the rebuilt temple in Jerusalem. Again, something prophesied by Daniel. He began to forbid Jews from following their own laws, from following their own customs, from following their own religion. And he required the Hellenization of the Jews. This became mandatory culture. Everything Jewish had to be put aside, and Hellenistic culture and views, it started being forced upon the Jews. Some Jews began to push back against that culture, which they should have. And ultimately, there was what's called the Maccabean Rebellion, and they kind of came out from that to some extent. But as they pushed back from this culture, as with many things that we do as humans, there began to be a lot that went into the other side of the ditch. They didn't just step away from the worldly culture. They began to go into another side of the ditch. And so by the time Matthew opens, you really have this perfect storm for the arrival of Jesus and for what Jesus was ultimately coming to the earth for. Two things really dominated the Jewish culture by that point, which blinded the Jews from seeing Jesus for who He is, their Messiah King. And instead, it led them to crucify Him. The first thing that really blinded them was because of this great persecution, which they had began to experience some 150 to 175 years prior to the coming of Christ, and because of the current occupation of Rome in their land, the Jews were crying out for deliverance. They wanted deliverance from this foreign people. They wanted to be rid of foreign dominance. This really sounds a lot like the Jews of the Old Testament in general. They were often occupied by foreign lands, foreign people, and God would deliver them from that foreign rule as a vast general rule up until we got to the captivity of the Assyrians and Babylonians. But as we get here, we have them crying out, wanting deliverance. That's what their hearts wanted. And so here comes Jesus, their long-awaited Messiah, showing Himself to be Messiah in every way really except one in their minds. He did not come and destroy Roman rule. He did not remove the foreigners from Jewish land and set up Israel as the center of the world, so to speak. Despite all of the other obvious and profound signs, which we will see in this book that Jesus provided to the Jews during His life, this one thing, this fact that He did not rid them of the Romans, which was really all they really cared about, and which was really what showed their hearts at this time, it turned them against Him. They cared nothing for the glory and the rule of Yahweh in their lives. They only saw God at this point as a vast general rule. The entire nation saw God as a means to an end, which their end in their minds was blessing and prosperity and, again, the rid of foreign rule. So when they got to the point where they believed Jesus could not provide that to them, and we will get to that eventually here in this book, they crucified Him. They cried for His crucifixion. The second thing that clouded their view, so to speak, was that ultimately, rooted in that long-established and fought-against Greek and Hellenistic influence among the Jews, there became to be a divide among the Israelites, specifically among the Israelite leaders. This divide was most profoundly seen there between the Jewish leaders. On one side, you have the Sadducees, who embraced that Hellenistic culture to a fault. They valued wealth as divine, and it led to all kinds of corruption among the Sadducees. They believed that men had free will in all things. Essentially, what they believed, though, with the free will is that God, He chose to play no role in the lives of men, and each man was the master of his own destiny. This, of course, justified their lavish living and their corrupt lifestyles under that Hellenistic culture. But on the other side, in the other ditch, if you will, were the Pharisees. They pushed back against these lavish and sinful lifestyles of the Hellenistic culture, and they held to the purity of the Mosaic Law above all. Now, this would have been great had they not been so radical, and again, not gone into the other side of the ditch. In their efforts to be religious and abide by the law of Moses, they had created many traditions, many extra-biblical traditions, requirements, which went well beyond the design and requirements of God's law, and they held all other Jews to that those man-made standards. Even worse, they believed themselves capable of perfectly following the law and their extra-biblical mandates, and they taught that that was what gained favor with God. They, of course, failed to see that despite their presumed obedience to the law, their hearts were far from God as well, and far from the God or the law of God. In the middle of these two groups, then, were the common people of Israel. So you can see why Jesus will tell them later in Matthew 15 that they were the blind leading the blind. The religious leaders were the blind leading the blind. The conflict between Jesus and these leaders and their rejection of Him is most often and profoundly shown in Matthew's account above all other gospel accounts. We will see that consistently and constantly as we work through this book. All right, under Roman occupation, Israel suffered a very oppressive tax system. It was cruel, it was relentless. And there were two taxes taken. One was called the poll tax, which was like our modern-day income tax. The other was called the ground tax, which is similar to our modern-day property or land tax. Now, how this would work is that Roman senators or wealthy magistrates of Rome, they would have the opportunity to buy at public auction the revenues from certain countries under Roman dominion. They had to do this at a fixed price. They would auction, they would, you know, bid on this, they'd get the fixed price, and then they would have 5 years to collect on this, on these revenues. Basically, it was up to them to collect this tax for 5 years. And so having paid that high initial investment price for this right, they would try to collect as much as possible from that nation whom they had the right to collect it from while they had that right to do it. Whoever won the auction was called the publicani. They would then recruit or sign on, hire, however you want to term it, a man called the publican who was native to an area, to the area of the country in which they had bought that right from, and they would have him go around and collect this exorbitant tax. They gave all kinds of liberties to this publican or this tax collector in their collecting of this tax, including allowing the tax collector to add on whatever he wanted to, the original tax, whatever they required him to collect. This publican or this tax collector could add on whatever else he wanted to and pocket it himself, and that way he could get wealthy. The senator or the magistrate, they largely didn't care what the tax collector did to collect it, as long as the tax collector did in fact get their money. Obviously, these publicans, these tax collectors, these men were generally hated by their countrymen, and they were seen as traitors. But they became wealthy in their positions, so who cares, right? They're making money. Most of these publicans were dishonest and cruel in their actions and how they collected this tax. They were seen on the same level by the Jews as harlots, robbers, murderers, and just heathen in general. We will see that as we work through this book. But that is where we find our author of this gospel. That is who and what Matthew was prior to Christ calling him out. As with nearly every book in the Bible, there have been a few attempts to explain away the rather obvious author, but there really is nothing worth mentioning. I won't get into any objections. There's really nothing worth mentioning. Matthew, also known as Levi the tax collector, is the author of this gospel. He was one of the 12 apostles whom Jesus called to be his disciple during his earthly ministry. And he's the one who, if you recall, he left everything, including this lucrative business, immediately upon the call of Jesus, and he followed him from that day forward. His authorship was well accepted and attested by the early church. Now, we can't be sure of the exact date when Matthew wrote this account, but most likely it was written as early as AD 44, all the way up to sometime right before AD 70, any time between in that gap. I know that's a pretty large gap. Most people accept around 40 to 50, 55 AD as the time period in which he wrote that. There's no way to know for sure, but it was certainly before AD 70. And while the gospel is generally composed chronologically, it begins with Jesus' birth and it ends with the passion story and then his ascension, we will see that Matthew will not write perfectly chronologically throughout the entire account. His focus at times will be more on topics instead of on chronological order. Again, we'll point that out when we get to those sections and those accounts, but we won't see it perfectly chronological in certain places. Chapters 1 through 4 are chronological. Chapters 5 through 13 are clustered more topically. And at times, again, through those chapters, Matthew will cluster details together which don't fit perfectly in that chronological timeline. But they do emphasize or explain the topic he is addressing in that chapter. Then in chapters 14 through 28, through the remainder of the book, they're arranged again chronologically. So what is the purpose of Matthew? What is the purpose of this book, the Gospel according to Matthew? The English word for gospel is derived from the Anglo-Saxon word godspell, which either means a story about God or a good story. This is very similar to the Greek word translated gospel, evangelion, which means good news. That's most commonly what we think of when we hear the term the gospel, or gospel, right? The good news. So each of the four Gospels in general, they were written primarily and firstly to tell a story about God. To tell the good news of the life, death, burial, and resurrection of the God-man Jesus. In each Gospel, though, you have doctrine and you have history which have helped the church to study the life of Christ and His doctrine. Both of those have been vital to the church throughout its history. Each gospel also has really an underlying focus or an underlying theme, if you will. The author had a specific either audience in mind or a specific purpose in mind, theme as he went through and wrote his account. When we went through John, we saw that John's emphasis really was on the deity and the power of Jesus. That's what his focus was. Seeking to show from his own eyewitness account how Jesus was the God-man. He was eternal deity cloaked in human flesh. When Todd went through Luke, he showed that Luke's purpose was primarily a Gentile focus, as it was written to a Gentile in order to tell him of the life and works of Jesus. Matthew's purpose in writing his gospel is much more Jewish focused. He wrote primarily to a Jewish audience with an emphasis on presenting Jesus as Israel's long-awaited Messiah and their rightful king. He quotes or references the Old Testament some 129 times, which is more, almost by double, than any of the other Gospels, and dozens of those quotations or references are given to show Jesus as the fulfillment of those Old Testament prophecies regarding the promised Messiah king who would come. Now, for the non-believing Jew, the idea that Jesus was the Messiah or the promised king from the line of David was preposterous. They never would have thought that was possible. They wouldn't have bought into that at all. Jesus had died, right? He died never having established a kingdom. He died without any of the Old Testament promises of the restoration of Israel being fulfilled. They were still in Roman captivity, or occupation, I guess is a better way to put it. So as Jews began to come to faith in Jesus, they were no doubt presented with these questions, which likely posed some doubt or concern and something they were consistently combating their friends and family with. So Matthew was writing to these Jewish Christians in the early church to show them, yes, Jesus did in fact come as their king, as the long-awaited Messiah, and offered the long-awaited and prophesied kingdom of heaven to them. Further, Matthew wrote to show that even in death, Jesus was the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy. And ultimately, the promises made to Israel of restoration through the new covenant were not canceled despite their rejection of Jesus as king in his first advent. They were just postponed for a period of time or a dispensation until Jesus returned. So, In its totality, and simply stated, Matthew's account is the story of the king who comes, the king who is rejected, and the king who will return. And that is what we will see in a nutshell through the book of Matthew. To further the point of Matthew's primary original audience, the Jewish audience, more than any other Gospels, Matthew's account is very Jewish. There are quite a few things you could point out that prove that, just show that within the account, clues that show that. But just to name a couple, the term kingdom of heaven, which is a very distinct Jewish phrase, appears 32 times within the Gospel and no times in any of the other Gospels. Matthew uses the phrase son of David, which is a term well connected by the Jews to that long-awaited king, the son of David. It's used 9 times here in the book of Matthew, more than double any other gospel as well. This is a very doctrinally focused gospel. As we will work through it, we will see that. No other gospel records as much of the teaching of Jesus as Matthew does. To that point, Matthew records 5 major discourses or sermons by Jesus, each one ending with a variation of the phrase, when Jesus had ended these sayings. So we know the end of the sermon or the end of the discourse. Those 5 discourses can be found, the first one in chapters 5-7 on what is commonly referred to as the Sermon on the Mount. The second is the commission given to the apostles in chapter 10. The third are referred to as the kingdom parables in chapter 13. The fourth being the childlikeness of the believer in chapter 18. And then the fifth pertains to his second coming in chapters 24 and 25. So having stated the purpose, what are some of the themes that we will encounter as we work through this book? Well, as I mentioned already, there is really one primary theme in Matthew's account of the gospel of Jesus. It is that Jesus is Messiah King. There is an emphasis that Matthew places on that royal office Jesus holds as the son of David. Quoting John MacArthur, and this is a little bit lengthy, so stick with me, but I thought it was a great summary of this theme. The first thing you notice in Matthew's gospel is that Christ is presented as a king. The person of Jesus is painted in royal colors. His ancestry is traced from the royal line. His birth is dreaded by a rival king. Wise men offer their royal gifts. His herald, John the Baptist, declared that his kingdom is at hand. Even in his temptation, you see the royalty of the person because the temptation itself reaches a climax when he, by Satan, is offered the kingdoms of the world, an acknowledgement by Satan that he has the right to rule. His great message on the Mount was the manifesto of the king setting forth the laws of his kingdom. His miracles were royal credentials. His parables were called the mysteries of the kingdom. He was hailed the son of David. He claims freedom to pay tribute to the kings of the earth, for he himself is a child of the king. He makes a royal entry into Jerusalem and claims sovereignty. And while facing the cross, he predicted his future reign. He claimed to have dominion over the angels. His last words are a kingly claim and a royal command as he says, "All authority has been given to me. Go therefore." And so Matthew presents him as a king revealed. I thought that was a good summary of the primary and overarching theme Matthew has in this gospel. A second thing we will see, though, kind of in a way of contrast to the view of Jesus during his life, Matthew draws constant attention to the Jews' rejection of Jesus as the Christ throughout his account. As I mentioned earlier, Matthew shows the conflict between Jesus and the Pharisees and Sadducees more than any other gospel. Further, beginning in the flight from Egypt near his birth to the scene at the cross, Matthew outlines the attacks on and the rejection of Jesus more than any other gospel as well. Again, as MacArthur puts it, the shadow of rejection is never lifted from the story. Still, we see as we work through this book that Matthew proves over and over from the Hebrew Scriptures that Jesus was and is in fact Messiah King. They just rejected Him. A third theme we will see, because of the Jews' rejection of Jesus as their King, Matthew, again more than any other gospel, will highlight the inclusion of the Gentiles in God's future plan of salvation and worship. He is the only author to include the Gentile Magi coming and worshiping the Christ child in chapter 2. Only Matthew speaks of Israel being judged for their rejection and unbelief, which will result in the kingdom being given to another nation or a people for a period there in chapter 21 of this book. Only Matthew includes the Great Commission, which was meant to go into all the world, to the Gentiles, there in chapter 28. And Matthew is the only gospel which uses the word church, and he does so two times, in chapter 16 and chapter 18. So clearly we'll see Matthew including and showing the inclusion of the Gentiles and ultimately in the plan of salvation and in the plan of worship for Christ during this dispensation. The fourth theme, Jesus will be shown as the new covenant lawgiver. As the prophet spoken of by Moses in Deuteronomy, who was to give his law for his follower, give the law for his followers to live by, in Matthew chapters 5 through 7, which again we commonly know as the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus presents this new covenant law to the people, to his followers. As the King of the Jews, he is declaring in that sermon essentially principles which his subjects were to follow. And there is great significance in that we hope to flesh out when we get there, but the gospel account will actually end there in chapter 8 with this theme, as Jesus will tell the apostles there as he's given the Great Commission, that the Great Commission is to encompass teaching others all that I have commanded you, right? All that I have taught you, they were to go and teach others. Finally, the fifth and final primary theme that we will see as we work through this book is, in light of that theme, the theme of Jesus as the new covenant lawgiver, we will see Matthew stress the theme also of being a disciple of Jesus. On many occasions, we'll see Matthew intertwine the dual truths of God's unmerited grace, but also the visible faith and obedience of that recipient of the unmerited grace. Matthew will teach often what it means to be a follower of Jesus, which, as I just mentioned, will culminate again there in Matthew 28 in the Great Commission. Quoting Charles Bloomberg, Matthew knows no salvation apart from Christ's lordship. Matthew himself is passionately convinced that the only valid response to his gospel account is to follow Jesus in the lifelong commitment of discipleship. This is a truth that we will see emphasized throughout the entire account that Matthew gives us. Okay, so there's our intro. That's what we should expect from Matthew as we work through this book. There will be many other things, I'm sure, that we'll have in this book that we will bring out that God has for us and that we will teach and learn. But those, I try to set out some of the primary themes and the primary expectations as we work through the book. So let's read through these first 17 verses and see what we can glean before we finish up tonight. Beginning in verse 1, the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers, and Judah the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar, and Perez the father of Hezron, and Hezron the father of Ram, and Ram the father of Amminadab, and Amminadab the father of Nahshon, and Nahshon the father of Salmon, and Salmon the father of Boaz by Rahab, and Boaz the father of Obed by Ruth, and Obed the father of Jesse, and Jesse the father of David the king. And David was the father of Solomon by the wife of Uriah, and Solomon the father of Rehoboam, and Rehoboam the father of Abijah, and Abijah the father of Asaph, and Asaph the father of Jehoshaphat, and Jehoshaphat the father of Jeroboam, and Jeroboam the father of Uzziah, and Uzziah the father of Jotham, and Jotham the father of Ahaz, and Ahaz the father of Hezekiah, and Hezekiah the father of Manasseh, and Manasseh the father of Amos, and Amos the father of Josiah, and Josiah the father of Jeconiah, and his brothers, at the time of the deportation to Babylon. Verse 12, and after the deportation to Babylon, Jeconiah was the father of Shealtiel, and Shealtiel the father of Zerubbabel, and Zerubbabel the father of Abiud, and Abiud the father of Eliakim, and Eliakim the father of Azor, and Azor the father of Zadok, and Zadok the father of Akim, and Akim the father of Eliud, and Eliud the father of Eleazar, and Eleazar the father of Mathan, and Mathan the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Joseph, and the husband of Mary, of whom Jesus was born, who is called Christ. So all the generations from Abraham to David were 14 generations. From David to deportation to Babylon, 14 generations. And from deportation to Babylon to the Christ, 14 generations. We will have a test with all those names later, so I hope you were listening and prepared. We will cover each one of these verses, all these 17 verses, but don't fret. We're not going to go into great detail about each one of these names, okay? Matthew begins here this genealogy and therefore the book by giving his readers really an immediate understanding as to his purpose in writing this gospel account. He states the following genealogy, verses 1 through 15, is that of Jesus the Christ. Now, I know most, or hopefully all of us at this point, already know, but Christ was not the last name of Jesus, right? Christ was not the surname for Jesus. It is a title. It was a title for Jesus. It means Messiah or anointed one. And this held significant meaning for the Jew. There were a lot of expectations that surrounded that title. There was a lot of disagreement, though, or confusion as to the expectation of the Messiah in that first century Palestine. Most really expected a military leader who would come in again and rid them of that Roman oppression, and he would set up then his earthly kingdom right then and there. In fact, most of the disciples of Christ, most of the apostles, had that expectation for most of Jesus' earthly ministry. But Matthew establishes here immediately that despite that expectation, and despite the fact that Jesus did not fulfill that expectation in his first coming, he was and he still is the long-awaited Messiah. Matthew also immediately ties Jesus to David as the son of David. Again, Matthew's focus is to show in every way that Jesus is in fact Messiah and King. Look, every Jew knew that the Messiah had to be from the line of David. It was through David that the Davidic covenant was established. To David was promised an eternal throne, an eternal king, and an eternal kingdom. If Matthew was going to establish then that Jesus was this Messiah King, he certainly would need to begin by showing that Jesus was in fact a son of David and part of that royal line. So he ties that immediately here into the genealogy. Matthew also states to begin with that he was a son of Abraham. Now, where Luke in his genealogy goes all the way back to Adam, Matthew, he's seeking just to prove again Jesus was of Jewish descent and of royal blood. So Abraham, being the father of the Jews, is where Matthew chose to go to, where he started really. It is no accident then that Matthew goes back to Abraham and that he uses this name Abraham instead of Abram. The name Abraham was directly connected to the covenant promises that God gave his people. Most significantly, as explained by Paul in Galatians 3, the connection Matthew really is making here when he said he's bringing up Abraham and being a son of Abraham, Paul addresses this in Galatians 3. He says, "Now the promises were made to Abraham and his offspring." It does not say offsprings, referring to many, but referring to one and to your offspring, who is Christ. So Matthew is making the messianic connection for his readers here in this first verse. Jesus is Christ. He is the Messiah. He is the Son of David. As Matthew goes on, he chose to break up this genealogy really in three sections. Verse 17 really laid these three sections out. Each one of these sections have 14 names. Now, a couple of the sections have a repeat of a name to make them 14, but that's Matthew's intent. He has a purpose behind that. He has 14 names in each one of these sections, but in this first section, detailed in verses 6 or 2 through 6a, Matthew goes from Abraham to David. So looking here, notice first, he mentions Judah. Judah is the only son of Jacob that he mentions. Now he does mention that his brothers, but Judah is the only one he mentions there in verse 2. And of course, this is because Judah was the line which David and Jesus came through, but also because Judah was the one who was promised rule, right? The scepter was given to Judah when Jacob blessed his sons in Genesis chapter 49. We read on, two of Judah's sons are mentioned here, Perez and Zerah. It was Perez, though, this first son mentioned, whom Jesus descended. Matthew ends this section with David, but notice how he states David. He titles David here. He says, David the King. Despite other kings being named in this genealogy, in fact, this next section we will get into, every name there just about is a king that sat on the throne. Despite these other kings being named in the genealogy, David is the only one that Matthew gives this title to. So he is placing significance on David, obviously, and he's drawing attention again to that Davidic covenant No other king after David, nor the son of David, nor any other son of David in the genealogy here could claim to be the son of David, right? Claim to be the one who would reign eternally, who would reign forever, who would bring in the covenant promises. They all died, and they all remain dead. There we go. We'll talk later. Jesus, on the other hand, lives forever, right? He did die, but he defeated death, and now he reigns and lives forever. Jesus is completely separate and apart from these other sons. He is the Son of David. The second section of this genealogy in verses 6b through 11 covers the time from David to the deportation to Babylon. Each one of these names mentioned here were kings of Judah at one point. Some here, we read, were godly kings, while some were evil kings. Matthew does not shy away from either, right, as he's going through this genealogy. I want to draw your attention, though, quickly to this final name mentioned, Jeconiah. Now, Jeconiah is also known by a couple other names, specifically Coniah. It is in this name that we really find a great distinction between Matthew's genealogy and Luke's genealogy. When we preached through Jeremiah a few years back, I actually preached Jeremiah 22. And Jeremiah 22, when I preached that book, it really stood out to me, and it stood out to me to this day, something that really hit home towards the end of that chapter. We'll mention here in a second. But I think I've mentioned this a couple of times when preaching other sermons. But I think there's a great significance there at the end of chapter 22 of Jeremiah on our passage here in Matthew. In Jeremiah 22, God is indicting the last few kings of Judah, the last few kings that would ever sit on the throne or that would sit on the throne of Judah before they go into the deportation, the final captivity of Babylon. And Ezekiel does this both by recounting the wickedness of these last few kings and their evil rule, and he also does so by comparing their rule over Judah to the last godly king, their father and grandfather, King Josiah, who was, the last godly king who sat on the throne there in Judah. But at the end of chapter 22, in speaking of Jeconiah, God pronounces a curse on him. In verse 29, Jeremiah writes, "O land, 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 hear the word of the Lord. Thus says the Lord, write this man down as childless, a man who shall not succeed in his days, for none of his offspring shall succeed in sitting on the throne of David and ruling in Judah again." So what was the curse pronounced on Jeconiah? Well, it's there in that last verse, right? That no one from his bloodline would ever sit on the throne of David again. He was the last one from his bloodline. There would never be another king of Judah from his bloodline. Now, we know he had a child because the genealogy we have here in Matthew tells us he did in fact have a child. But no one from his bloodline became king. After they were deported from Babylon and they came back, there was no men from his bloodline that sat on the throne of David. Zerubbabel, who was a descendant from him, was a leader of the people of Israel once they returned, but he was never a king. So how in the world could Jesus be king if Yahweh had cursed that bloodline, who Matthew says he came from? Did God go against his word and just make an exception for Jesus? Absolutely not. God doesn't do that, right? He doesn't go against his word. There are no exceptions. Before I give you the answer, notice first this final section here in verses 12 through 16. This section covers the time from deportation to Babylon to Christ. As I just pointed out, none of those names, save for Jeconiah, who was the part of the previous section as well, were ever kings of Israel. Matthew ends the genealogy here in a very unique way in these last few verses. He breaks from his normal formula, and you probably picked up on it as we read there, we got to Joseph. But he breaks from his normal formula of stating such and such was the father of such and such. And instead he says, Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom Jesus was born. So Joseph or Matthew is establishing here in no uncertain terms that Joseph was not the father of Jesus, right? He was the husband of Mary, whom Jesus was born, but Joseph was not the blood father of Jesus. He was the legal father, the adopted father of Jesus, but he was not the biological father. So Jesus was not part of the bloodline of Joseph, right? Not in a natural sense. He was not naturally part of that bloodline. And so he was not part of the natural bloodline of Jeconiah either, right? He was only the husband. Joseph was only the husband of Mary. The whom that we see here says, to whom, or of whom Jesus was born, that whom is also telling. It gives us more information, what the point Matthew's trying to make. This is in feminine form, whom. Matthew is clearly emphasizing in this the virgin birth of Jesus through Mary. Matthew is not only setting the foundation for his telling of how Jesus fulfilled the virgin birth prophecy from Isaiah 7, a point he will soon make in his account, but he is also showing how Jesus was not subject to that curse pronounced on the bloodline of Jeconiah in Jeremiah chapter 22. So how then could Jesus claim to be from the line of David and therefore the king promised to David, but not be part of this bloodline of Jeconiah, this side of this bloodline of David? I'm glad you asked. You will find many differences between the genealogy we have here in Matthew and the genealogy in Luke, which we have gone through previously, but it's been some years. But almost the whole genealogy is different, and there's a reason for that. The genealogy we get in Matthew is Joseph's bloodline, right? The genealogy which Luke gives is Mary's bloodline. Both bloodlines run back to David. Joseph's bloodline ran through Jeconiah all the way back through Solomon, the first son of David to sit on the throne after David's death. But Mary's bloodline, according to Luke, is traced back through Nathan, another son of David. So not only does Jesus have the legal right by succession according to the Jews because of his adopted father Joseph's bloodline, but he also is free from the curse that was given to that bloodline through Jeconiah, and he is still the sure fulfillment of the promise of David through Mary's bloodline. I don't know about you. I find that fascinating. I find how God has worked all of that out, and he's shown Jesus to be the legal father through Joseph's bloodline, yet not subject to the curse of that bloodline, and still he is part of the bloodline of David through Mary, through the virgin birth, unstained by the curse and obviously unstained by natural sin that we all have through our fathers. I find that fascinating. I hope you do too. I don't know. I thought that was a point worth bringing out. But all right, just to kind of conclude here, as you look at the genealogy, I think there's several things obviously we've mentioned and a few things that we can bring out. But one thing I want to end with is what we see, another thing we see here throughout the whole genealogy, kind of what we can glean from it. Now, you might have noticed that there are five women that were included in this genealogy. And that was very rare in Jewish genealogies. Generally, that women were not included at all. It was just the fathers. But here we have five: Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, Bathsheba, and then finally Mary is part of that. Not only does Matthew establish the line of David in here for Jesus through these men, but he does including several of these women as well. And I think there's a couple of reasons that we see in him doing that. There's some humility here for the Jews, I think, that Matthew is bringing in. And not just with the women, but with the whole line in general. Humility in that so many sinful and wicked men were part of this line, right? I mean, there were a lot of sinful and wicked men in the line of Christ. Shocker, every one of the men were sinful, right? I mean, every prior descendant of Christ, or prior father of Christ in this line, they were full of sin. They had sin. But there were some really wicked kings, really wicked men that were part of this line. And the inclusion of the women again, in modern or in this time, for the Middle Eastern, the Palestinians at this time, was a point of humility as well. I mean, women were seen as second-class citizens. They were seen as lower than men, no question about it. I mean, that's the view of what women were at this time. And so as Matthew includes five of them in this genealogy, he's presenting some humility, a reminder to the Jews that they're not to look down on anyone as second-class citizens with Christ having come and Christ having died for all women and men. He's also showing, I think, hope and mercy in this genealogy. Again, you can go to the women. There are two that were not part of the Israelite bloodline originally. They were pagans. They were brought in to this bloodline from outside. They were not originally Jewish. They were not originally Israelites. You have a harlot here. You have two who committed adultery. Ruth is a shining example in many ways, but she is a Gentile that came into the bloodline. And obviously, Mary is a great example for us in this, in her life and what she presented as well, and what we will see in this account. But there is mercy in shown in each one, right? And again, mercy shown in the inclusion of these wicked and sinful men throughout this genealogy. If the line of Christ, the God-man, the Messiah, it still descended from these men and these women, there, and He brought salvation with Him, we are to see mercy. We are to see the inclusion and the equality under Christ in both men, women, Gentiles, Jews. In this dispensation, under the blood of Christ, we are all saved the same way, right? We are all equal in that way. Now, obviously, God has roles. He's got leadership and He's got submission, and we're not going to get into that, and I'm not getting into that. That's not part of what I'm saying, but we are all one in Christ. We are all, none of us are second-class citizens, and I think we see that here just in this genealogy. I think that's one thing that we can see Matthew is kind of bringing out and pointing here. King Jesus brought with Him grace, brought with Him mercy, brought with Him no second-class believer. All right, that's all I've got tonight. Stand with me.